Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Stephen M. Wise. He's president of the Non-Human Rights Project. He holds a JD from Boston University Law School and a BS in chemistry from the College of William and Mary. He's practiced animal protection law for 30 years throughout the United States and is admitted to the Massachusetts Bar. Steve teaches animal rights jurisprudence at the Vermont, Lewis and Clark, University of Miami, and St. Thomas Law Schools, and has taught animal rights law at the Harvard Law School and John Marshall Law School. He's the author of four books, Rattling the Cage, Toward Legal Rights for Animals, Drawing the Line, Science and the Case for Animal Rights, Though the Heavens May Fall, the landmark trial that led to the end of human slavery, and an American trilogy, Death, Slavery, and Dominion, along the banks of the Cape Fear River. So first, thank you for your just tireless work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So, what is the Non-Human Rights Project?
The Non-Human Rights Project is now 20 years old, but it really has only come into prominence in the last 2 years. And the purpose of the Non-Human Rights Project is to break through the legal wall that separates all animals, non-human animals, from all human beings. There's, if you can imagine there being this great legal wall that first separates persons from things. Persons are those entities who have the capacity for one or more legal rights, and things are those entities that don't have the capacity for any legal rights at all. Right now, if you take a snapshot here as 2015 ends of that wall, you'll see that on the person side are all human beings. Every human being now, as we approach 2016, has the capacity for one or more legal rights, usually an infinite number. On the other side of that wall still remain all of the non-human animals in the world, and they continue not to have any capacity for any legal rights at all. But you have to understand that that's a snapshot. If you had taken that snapshot 200 years ago, you would have found that joining the non-human animals of the world on the thing side would have been human slaves, would have been women, would have been children, would have been other kinds of human beings. And indeed, a great deal of the civil rights work of the last two centuries has been to bang a hole through that legal wall and pass through all these humans, you know, one at a time, slaves, women, children, from the thing side of the wall to the person side of the wall, so that now all human beings do indeed have legal rights. And so what we're trying to do is to reopen that hole and begin passing through those non-human animals who ought to have legal rights as well, to protect their most fundamental interests. And that's really the work of the Non-Human Rights Project. First, to break through that wall for the first time, and the second thing is to begin passing through as many non-human animals as we can to the person side.
And so I know this is kind of off the subject, but aren't there also some on the right side, aren't there also corporations, ships and cities or something? Aren't there also some things that definitely have some rights?
Yes, there are. And indeed, if you want to hear me talk about that specifically and lots of other things, I gave a TED talk in Vancouver in February of 2015, in which I explain all these probably at least as well as I'm going to explain it today. And so you are indeed right. On that person side are also some non-human entities. Corporations, indeed, are one, and ships and states, governments, entities, governmental entities, they indeed are also legal persons who have the capacity for at least one legal right. But perhaps more interestingly enough is that other common law countries, some of our sister common law countries, you know, English-speaking countries, such as India, has said in a case from the mid-1920s that a Hindu idol was a person who had certain legal rights. In 2000, the Indian Supreme Court said that the holy books of the Sikh religion is a person that has legal rights. And perhaps the most interesting is in 2012, the indigenous peoples of New Zealand signed a treaty with the Crown in which it was said that a certain river, the Whanganui Iwi River in New Zealand, also was a person who had certain legal rights, including the right to own its own bed.
So what Let's go back to the, thank you for that. And let's go back to the Non-Human Rights Project. And what have you been doing over the past, how many years has the Non-Human Rights Project existed, did you say?
The Non-Human Rights Project came into existence in 1995.
And so what have you and the project been doing for the last 20 years to try, how have you been trying to break down this wall?
Well, it began actually 10 years before that in 1985, before I formed the Non-Human Rights Project. At that time, I realized, and I was also working with a colleague of mine from the Animal Legal Defense Fund. He was the treasurer at the time. I was the president at the time in 1985. We realized that indeed it was a very serious problem that in any entity who is not a legal person has even its most fundamental interests not protected. And so it was important in order to begin to protect the fundamental, even the most fundamental interests of non-human animals, that we had to somehow figure out a strategy for making them legal persons instead of legal things. And for the next 10 years, first I began working with David Faber, and then about 4 or 5 years into it, he left to assume the temporary deanship of his law school, and then I began working on my own. And I spent a lot of those years thinking about it, reading about it, trying to understand where legal rights came from, why humans have rights, why non-human animals don't have rights. I began to look at law back to as early as law is known, back to Mesopotamian law, and then I studied Roman law and Hebrew law and Greek law and civil law and common law. And so it took most of those 10 years for me to begin to figure out how we might be able to have some kind of a reasonable approach that would lead us to actually breaking through that wall. And so in 1995, I began to write my first law review articles, because that was one of the things that I was also planning in the 1980s and the early 1990s, was to not only to have me understand how we might be able to break through that wall, but to begin to try to prepare the rest of the world, or possibly wait for the rest of the world to catch up. Not only the non-legal world, but the legal world itself, to accept the kind of ideas that, although I didn't understand them fully, I knew that they were coming. And so in 1990, I began to teach animal rights jurisprudence at the Vermont Law School. And later on in 2000, I would teach the first class in animal rights jurisprudence at the Harvard Law School. And these ideas I felt were maturing fast enough so that about 1995, I thought it was time to at least try to form an organization, which I called at that time, the Center for the Expansion of Fundamental Rights. And I kept that name until 2007. And the purpose of that was when the time was right, I would have a 501c3 that would be ready to really swing into gear. And so I began to write a series of law review articles throughout the later last half of the 1990s. And then throughout the first 8 or 9 years of the 2000s, I then wrote the 4 books that you talked about. And by about 2007, I'd come to the conclusion that after 22 years, I understood what it is I wanted to do and how we might be able to prevail. And I wrote an email to a lot of people I know saying, I'm done theorizing. I understand what I'm doing. The world is catching up to us. Now it's time to really get prepared to start filing lawsuits and test the limits of these theories. And so as I taught, as I lectured around the country and around the world, I would ask people to volunteer for what then was called the Center for the Expansion of Fundamental Rights, and began to hand out a large number of homework assignments saying, I want you to research this, I want you to research that, I want you to research this third thing, until by the time we were finished, people were researching perhaps 60 different legal issues across all 50 states. So it was really a very lengthy and complex problem. And by the year 2010, I was supervising perhaps 70 people, that's 70, all across the country, most of them doing legal research, but other people beginning to help form the corporation, who are doing fundraising or who are doing social media or all the things that you have to do in order to have a modern organization going. And so we decided by about 2010 that we were aiming to file the first suits no later than 2013. And we had to make, again, about 3,000, 3,500 separate decisions trying to figure out what would be the best jurisdiction. Where might we encounter the least resistance, or where might people feel the – or judges be the least hostile, or the judges be the most friendly to the kind of arguments that we were making. So that took a lot of years and 10, 20, 30,000 man hours to do. And then we also had to decide what animals we were going to have as our first petitioners. And we – long ago, as I was writing the books, I thought, I think the best – non-human animals should be any of the four species of great apes, chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans, either of the two species of elephants, either African or Asian elephants, or certain cetaceans, whales and dolphins, such an animal as an orca, for example. And so eventually in 2012 and 2013, we began to match these animals where they were throughout the United States with the hierarchy of states from 1 to 50 that we had come up with. And so on Easter Sunday of 2013, the legal working group was meeting in Times Square at the suite hotel that we usually did every 3 or 4 months. And we decided that on December 2nd, 2013, we would file the first suits on behalf of chimpanzees in the state of New York, and that we were going to, as our cause of action, use the common law writ of habeas corpus. And that was something that I had been thinking about for 20 years, and I was so interested in that, and it was such an attractive cause of action for us that I'd taken 3 years off in the middle of the 2000s and written a book called Though the Heavens May Fall, which told the story of how a black slave named James Somerset had used the common law writ of habeas corpus in London to break through that wall, to move him, a black slave, from being a thing to being a person. And I had studied what his attorneys had done. I'd studied what the judge had done. I'd try to understand what were the political and the social and the intellectual influences that were pushing and pulling on the judge, Lord Mansfield, who was one of the greatest judges ever to speak English. And we decided that we would model our work on the work in the Somerset case. And so we decided on Easter Sunday of 2013 that we would sue on behalf of two specific chimpanzees named Reba and Merle, who were in a roadside zoo in Catskill, New York. A month later, I went out to see them, and I learned that Reba had died just about the time we had decided to file a suit on her behalf. We decided to keep going on behalf of Merlin. I sent my executive director out to that zoo again in September 2013, and we learned that Merlin had died the night before. So at that point, we were horrified for many reasons, and we decided that we had a moral obligation to try to identify every chimpanzee in the state of New York and virtually simultaneously seek common law writs of habeas corpus on behalf of all of them. And that's what we did. Over the next 2 months, we identified all the real and possible chimpanzees in the state of New York. We went out and we tried to eyeball them, make sure that they were there. And indeed, some of them who we thought were there did not actually exist. Some of them did exist, and then they died. And by December 2nd of 2013, there were four chimpanzees in three places. There was Kiko, who was being held by himself in a cage in a cement storefront in Niagara Falls. There was Tommy, who was being held by himself in a cage on a used trailer lot in Gloversville, New York, which is a very tiny town. And then there were Hercules and Leo. And Hercules and Leo were young chimpanzees. Then they were about 7 or 8 years old, who had been forced to undergo experiments at Stony Brook University since they were the age of 3, where they had come from this terrible place called New Iberia in Louisiana. And we learned that wires had been forced into them, that they had been repeatedly anesthetized, and it wasn't even for medical purposes. It was in order to satisfy the curiosity of professors in the anatomy department who wanted to know how chimpanzees walked. which we felt was a disgrace. And so we then almost simultaneously, that or certainly that week, the first week of December 2013, we went from Gloversville to Niagara Falls to Long Island, where Stony Brook was, and we filed the first three suits seeking common law writs of habeas corpus on behalf of a non-human animal anywhere, certainly in the English-speaking world. And then we began to see how the judges were going to react to all the work we had been doing for so many years.
So I want to ask how the judges have responded, but there's a couple things I want to take a couple of detours first.
Sure.
And the first one, I just want to mention that through all this, I've had tears in my eyes because this is all so profoundly moving to me. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I want to take another detour to say, before we talk about the actual cases, I just want to comment explicitly for all activists listening to this, that this should be a study, that people should study what you've done for how to build a movement. Because everything you just said, I think people should listen to again and again and either contact you or read more about how you've done this, because it is so crucial to do this groundwork first before you dive in. I mean, it's necessary to have action, and you know, every day that passes is a day that more atrocities occur. We all know that, but at the same time, you have to prepare. And I think a lot of people don't really understand that. And I just want to express admiration for the patience and thoroughness with which you developed the movement necessary to do this.
Well, thank you. And if I may say, about 4 or 5 years ago, I began to think that what we were doing was indeed important to document. And ultimately, the documentary filmmaker, D.A. Pennybaker, and his wife and fellow filmmaker, Chris Hedges, agreed to begin filming what we were doing over the 3 years that led up to our litigation. And they've been filming it ever since. And the film is just being finished now. It was purchased by HBO, and it's having its world premiere at the Sundance Film Festival on January 25th in Park City, Utah. And it's called Unlocking the Cage. So if someone wants to see a film that covers the last 4 years of what we did, you'll be able to see that.
Well, I think that's really great. And I just want to say again that I think you've provided a model that could be scalable out to no matter what issues the people are working on. And, you know, even in my own lifetime, I don't mean to go on about this, but even in my own lifetime, you know, I'm a very prolific writer. And part of the reason that I'm so prolific starting in my 30s is because in my 20s, I spent a lot of time learning. It's like Joseph Campbell said that he said he spent his 20s learning how to write, so when he had something to write in his 30s, he would know how to do it. That's the same thing here. You know, you spent all this time educating yourself. And an image that keeps coming to mind, which is unfortunately from a war, is, you know, don't shoot till you see the whites of their eyes. And it's like, you know, you want to prepare and prepare and prepare. Or take another war metaphor. Nathan Bedford Forrest, who's a horrible racist, said that, and also a great general, said that the way you win a battle is by getting there first with the most. And yes. So, you know, it's the same thing, that you prepared and prepared. Okay, I've beaten that to death enough. I just think it's fabulous, and I wanted to say that.
Well, it's obviously we have a lot more to do, and I am eventually going to be writing a fifth book, which will tell the story of what we're doing. I just haven't been able to do that yet. But one of the things we did was to try to figure out what's the best chance? How can we make our chances of winning the best? Because what we want to do more than anything else is win. We're not interested in going down in glorious flames. We're interested in winning, in breaking through the wall, and then beginning to expand that as much as we can. And so very early on, I concluded that the way to do that was to not introduce anything more novel than we had to. And so we wanted to. That's one of the reasons I spent so many years trying to understand where law comes from, where rights come from, what do judges learn in – we wanted to be able to make arguments that judges intuitively value, that that they had learned about as they were growing up, that they learned in college, that they learned in law school, that they worked with every day as lawyers, that they worked with every day as judges. And so we wanted to figure out how we could present legal arguments to them that automatically would resonate within them. And the only difference that they would have in trying to make their decision from a normal case is that the plaintiff happens to be a non-human animal and not a human being. So we tried to make the arguments as commonplace as we possibly could. And that took a long time. But I think now, 30 years on, that we did the exact right thing. And we're not afraid to stand up and argue, for example, that non-human animals are entitled to certain fundamental rights as a matter of liberty, as a matter of equality. In fact, those are our two linchpins. We decided a long time ago that liberty and equality were these two values that people in the West, certainly, and in the United States very much so, value and have valued. Even when we didn't live up to them, we still gave lip service to them, and we still intuitively value them, even when we might argue about what they might actually mean. And so we have crafted our legal arguments to be absolutely middle-of-the-road legal arguments, with the only difference being that we are litigating on behalf of a non-human animal and not a human being. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, that I wrote Though the Heavens May Fall, to understand how James Somerset's lawyers made their breakthrough. And we indeed rest of some parts of our argument on how lawyers before us brought lawsuits on behalf of African Americans or black people in other countries, how they are able to free them through litigation, as well as Native Americans in the U.S. For example, we cite the Standing Bear case, which was from 1879, which up until that time, a Native American had never been able to use a common law writ of habeas corpus. When the Army put him in jail, there he stayed. And finally, a Native American named Standing Bear claimed that he could use a writ of habeas corpus. And the U.S. government argued that he was not a person who could use a writ of habeas corpus. And the judge said, well, I'm going to find that he is a person. And again, person does not mean human being, as you know, because of that wall. You can see that some persons are human beings, some persons are not human beings. Human beings have not been persons. And so person is a technical legal concept. It means someone who has the capacity for a legal right. So what we do is study very hard what the law is, what judges value, what their fundamental values are, and we go into court and we argue those.
So, okay, before we get to the progress, we're in 2013, and yes. Before we get to the progress, give me your the attorneys for the other side, give me their very best two or three arguments.
Well, we haven't had a whole lot of attorneys, by the way, show up on the other side, which has been a real problem for us. We filed suit on behalf of the four chimpanzees: Tommy, who is in Glover in central New York, Kiko, who's in western New York, and then Hercules and Leo, who are on Long Island. When we filed our suits against the owners of the people who said they were the owners of Tommy and Kiko, they refused to appear. They didn't send a lawyer in. And we found ourselves in a very difficult role of not having someone to argue against us. And at first we thought, well, this is great. But then as we began to understand more deeply what was going on, we realized that there was a reasonable chance that the judges were doing more than just judging. They may also have been really even unconsciously taking the side of the people who were not there, of the parties who were not there. When we filed,
wait. One thing, yes. Real quick. I thought that if you didn't show up for a trial, that kind of meant you automatically lost. But that's not true?
It did not happen here, no. The judges we did not automatically lose. We still had to persuade them. And I won't even get into all of the various things that we had to persuade them about, because while we were using middle-of-the-road and kind of legal values and principles, the fact is that they had never actually been applied to a non-human being. So it remained, you know, very much up in the air to what degree judges were going to accept the arguments we made on behalf of non-human beings. When we filed suit against Hercules and Leo, against Stony Brook, who were using Hercules and Leo, the Attorney General of New York came in, and we were delighted finally to have a worthy opponent, which was the Attorney General of New York. And so now I'm trying to think of the best arguments that the Attorney General of New York makes, and I think the best arguments that they make is really it's never been done before. And also, watch out, Judge. There's a slippery slope. If you extend anywhere past a human being, and you allow a chimpanzee to be a person, well, then you're going to allow mice to be persons, and cockroaches to be persons, and ants to be persons. There's no way of drawing a rational line, and that seemed to be the major arguments. We didn't think that they were very good legal arguments, but those were the major arguments. And we were really pleased in the Hercules and Leo case that the judge specifically dismissed the slippery slope argument, saying, whether that slope is slippery or not, if the party in front of me, whether she's a human or a non-human animal, has a certain right that I'm going to grant it to her, whether or not that then applies to some other non-human animal is going to be a job for another judge.
That's great. Okay, so what happened?
Well, we understood that this was the first time that this had ever been done, and that while I had been working on it for 30 years, and some of the people around me had now been working on it for 6 or 7 years, that these judges were going to be blindsided. They would have never thought about this in their entire lives. So in New York, what you do is that you go into court and you can go in what's called ex parte, which means you go in without giving notice to the other side, and you ask that the judge issue what's called an order to show cause, meaning the judge orders the captor of the chimpanzee to come into court and give a legally sufficient reason for imprisoning the chimpanzee. We thought that it was likely that none of the first three cases we filed would end up in the judge even giving us a hearing on that, even allowing us to come in by ourselves, but would just simply say, hey, chimpanzees are not persons, and then we'd have to begin the appellate process. We were pleasantly surprised that the first judge did indeed give us a hearing. He, after about an hour or two of argument, he said he with great regret, actually, he was going to rule against us on the grounds that a chimpanzee could not be a legal person. We said fine, and we appealed that. Then we went out to the following day to Niagara Falls, and that judge wanted to think about it for a few days, and we had a hearing about 3 or 4 days later, and I was allowed to make my argument, and that judge was very honest. He came right out and said, I'm not going to be the first to make this leap of faith, to take this leap of faith. So he ruled against us on the ground that a chimpanzee was not a person, which is what we expected, and we appealed that up to a different appellate court. We then flew to Long Island, and that's where we were confronted with what we had thought was going to happen to us all along. The judge ruled against us. They said that a chimpanzee was not a person, and we never saw the judge. The judge didn't even want to speak to us about it. He simply said, you lose, a chimpanzee is not a person, and then we appealed that up. Then it began to get really interesting, and it's continued to be really interesting. What happened was that when we appealed the Hercules and Leo case, which was the one that we had filed last, and the judge had not even wanted to see us, we appealed, and almost immediately, the appellate court for that jurisdiction, the intermediate appellate court for that jurisdiction in the state of New York, threw our case out on the grounds that we didn't even have the right to appeal. Now, we had spent years and years studying all 50 states' law, and one of the reasons that we really liked the state of New York is that we knew we did have the right to appeal. And so, but that appellate court just simply threw us out on the grounds we didn't have a right to appeal. We decided not to try to appeal that to a higher court. But what we did is we said, we're going to then appeal. We're going to refile the case in another court in another jurisdiction. That was another reason we had chosen the state of New York, is that we thought what lawyers called venue was not an important problem, that we had venue and that we could file a lawsuit on behalf of a chimpanzee, any chimpanzee, in any court we wanted to in the entire state of New York. So we decided we were going to do that. But first, we turned our attention to the other two cases involving Tommy and Kiko. When we argued in front of the intermediate appellate court in Tommy's case, we ran into the problem that the court said that the only entity who could ever have a who could ever be a legal person for any reason whatsoever had to be an entity who could shoulder duties and responsibilities. They used a very, very narrow philosophical argument about duties and responsibilities based on a theory of contract. All we could tell them was that that's not what the Court of Appeals, which was the highest court of New York, that's not what it said. And so you were not following the Court of Appeals, and that we could find no court in any English speaking country who had ever said what they were saying. But that's what they decided to say, and we had to live with that. And so they also said, by the way, chimpanzees cannot shoulder duties and responsibilities. So therefore, since you must be able to do that, you lose.
Well, a ship can't shoulder responsibility.
Well, neither can a one-year-old child. No joke. And so it appeared from the decision itself that as they were planning on as they were going to publish it, somebody had pointed that out, and they put in what seemed to be to us to be a hasty footnote that essentially said, "Don't worry, this doesn't apply to human beings." In other words, it was just kind of a bit of speciesism that they put in the footnote in order to have us lose.
Well, they could have said the same thing 200 years ago about, by the way, this doesn't apply to white human beings.
That's exactly right, and we informed them of that. That's what they decided to do. So it was interesting in that this second appellate court ignored what the first appellate court did. Remember, the first appellate court said that we could not even appeal. The second appellate court ignored them, agreed with that we could appeal, and then ruled against us on the grounds that chimpanzees could not shoulder duties and responsibilities. We then went to the third appellate court on behalf of Kiko. That appellate court ignored both the first appellate court, which had said we couldn't appeal, and they ignored the second appellate court, which said that you had to have duties and be able to shoulder duties and responsibilities. And they came up with a third reason. And that reason was that the use of habeas corpus on behalf of any entity, human or chimpanzee, was improper if you were not going to give them an unconditional freedom, but you were simply going to move them from one place of detention to another place of detention. Because obviously, the chimpanzees that were being held captive, we couldn't simply open up their cage and send them out into the world. They would be killed. What we were doing was sending them to Save the Chimps, which was a sanctuary in South Florida, not far from where I am. And so we tried to explain, we explained to the court that was not the law in the state of New York, but that court did what it wanted. So our first three appellate courts, we lost for three different reasons, and none of the courts acknowledged that the other courts had dismissed our case. So what we then – another reason that we've filed suit in the state of New York – and I think I may have spoken about this – is that you can keep filing cases again and again and again. What lawyers call res judicata does not apply to habeas corpus cases. So, for example, say I buy a car from you and then I end up suing you for breach of contract and I lose. Once I lose, I then can't sue you for breach of contract again and then again until I finally win. There's something called res judicata. The thing is settled. But there is an exception to that, and that is, at least in the state of New York, the common law writ of habeas corpus. And so one of the reasons we chose the state of New York was that we understood that this was something completely novel, that the odds of us making a mistake these first few times around were high. The odds of the judges making a mistake the first few times around were high. So we wanted to be able to refile and refile and refile. And that's exactly what we did. We then began to refile all of the cases one by one. And we refiled the Hercules and Leo case first. And that was in April of 2015, earlier this year. And for the first time, we did indeed have a breakthrough. For the first time, Justice Barbara Jaffe of the New York County Supreme Court did issue an order to show cause. So that was the very first time, certainly in the English-speaking world, that any judge had ever issued an order to show cause on behalf of a non-human animal for any purpose anywhere. And she ordered Stony Brook to come in and give a legally sufficient reason why they were keeping Hercules and Leo in prison. We had a very well-publicized two-hour shootout in her courtroom, and then she took 2 months to write a very thoughtful opinion in which she sided with us on every single thing, including, by the way, for the very first time, a human or a corporation, which is what the Non-Human Rights Project is, that was not injured, was given what lawyers call standing to sue on behalf of a non-human animal who was injured. That had never happened before. So that was one of the many things, many times she sided with us. How the reason we then ultimately lost on one thing. We lost because she said that as a lower court judge, even though she wasn't in the same intermediate appellate department as the Tommy case had been, she believed that she was bound by them saying that you had to be able to shoulder duties and responsibilities in order to be a person, and that chimpanzees could not do that. And that was the reason we lost. So what we did is we went out and spoke to Jane Goodall and spoke to many of our other experts, because we filed the first time around over 100 pages of affidavits from experts from Japan, from Sweden, Germany, England, Scotland, and the United States in favor of the various arguments from liberty and equality that we were making. And we then went to some of these experts, as well as this time to Jane Goodall, who's on my board of directors, and we asked if they could file further affidavits that specifically address the issue of can chimpanzees bear duties and responsibilities. And we got 60 more pages of affidavits that demonstrate, yes, they can. And so about 4 weeks ago, we actually refiled Tommy's case in New York County and got sent to the same judge, Barbara Jaffe, again. This time she did not issue the order to show cause, but what she did is that she said that she did not see why she had to issue a new order to show cause because of the fact that our arguments were not substantially different the second time than they were on the first time. We were puzzled by that since we filed 60 more pages of new affidavits and we made 40 more pages of arguments. And today, a week after, actually, it's only been about 5 days since we got that decision from her. We've been kind of perplexed why she said that. And so we are now refiling Kiko's case in her court or in New York County about January 5th, in which we're going to make it absolutely clear how we have filed 60 more pages of affidavits, that none of the things we're talking about have ever been raised before in any other court. And we'll see whether she issues the order to show cause this time. And if she does, great. If she doesn't, then both Tommy and Kiko and Hercules and Leo, all three cases will now then go up on appeal to the intermediate appellate court that sits for Manhattan. And then we'll see what happens. And ultimately, we'll keep trying to go to the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court. Meanwhile, while we continue to litigate in the state of New York, we've begun researching a case and bringing in affidavits on behalf of a case involving elephants. We plan on filing a lawsuit in 2016 as early as we can on behalf of elephants in a state that's not New York. And then we're also beginning to work on filing a lawsuit on behalf of either an ape or an elephant or a cetacean in a third state. And we're hoping to get both of those two cases filed sometime in 2016. And we'll begin to see how the courts deal with other non-human animals. And we'll begin to see how the various states might deal with them as well.
So, and I'm presuming, I don't know enough about the history of the abolition of human slavery to know, but I'm presuming that this is actually very common in attempting to extend rights to those who have not before then had rights to lose and lose and lose and lose and lose until eventually you start winning.
It certainly happens. That's exactly right. And we are committed to winning. And if we lose, we sit back and we say, why did we lose? How can we fix it? And we go back again. And if we lose then, we'll sit back and say, why did we lose? We'll fix it and we'll go back again. And eventually, the judges will either have to do one of two things. They're either going to have to agree with us, which is what we think justice requires them to do, or they're just going to have to come out and make just a blatantly speciesist statement, which is non-human animals, even if they can give their own speech and they're smarter than Albert Einstein, can never have rights. And we think that that statement conflicts so sharply with ideas of liberty, ideas of equality, ideas of fairness, that if a judge ever does that, if a court ever does that, it will be an inherently unstable judicial decision that we will eventually be able to push over.
You know, there's when I asked you what arguments the other side makes, there was one I was expecting you to say that you didn't, and that's that I'm thinking about Johnson v. McIntyre or McIntosh, whichever it is.
Oh, the 1830s or so.
And also a lot of the arguments for human slavery were, well, if we actually stop this, well, it's McIntyre, right?
I think so.
Yeah,
McIntosh. I'm one of the.
Oh, it's McIntosh. I'm sorry, it's McIntosh.
And you know what? It was a disgraceful decision.
Oh, of course it was.
But at the time, obviously, it wasn't seemed to be that way. And what we try to do is gently nudge the judges into the realization that if they rule against us on such a ground, that they will be handing down a disgraceful ruling that history will not judge them kindly on.
And for listeners, the core or part of that ruling was that it was about American Indian rights to land, and it was basically if your entire system is built upon what may be a manifest injustice, it doesn't matter because, in the words of the Supreme Court justice, quote, it cannot be questioned. And so I was wondering, have they not made the argument, well, you can't do this because it will interfere with commerce and basically destroy life as we know it?
Well, when they talk about the slippery slope, that is really it's going to destroy life as we know it. We'll all become vegans. We'll be required to be vegans. The whole world will change. We can't wear them. We can't use them. We can't exploit them. And what we say to the judge is that we're not dealing with that. What we're dealing, judge, right now in front of you, is that we have an imprisoned chimpanzee who is extraordinarily cognitively complex, who's self-conscious, who's autonomous, who can shoulder duties and responsibilities. And that chimpanzee deserves justice. And as to the next case, we'll see what that judge says. The next case, we'll see what that judge says. And also, of course, many, many arguments throughout the ages have been made that if a court does this or a legislature does that, then the world as we know it will collapse. And there's some parts of the world that we know it that ought to collapse because they're entirely immoral. And those kinds of arguments indeed were made around black chattel slavery.
Which leads to the line which I would like for you to say about though the heavens may fall. Can you talk about that very briefly? We've got 5 minutes left. So
sure.
Talk about that and then I'll do a sum up. So though the heavens may fall addresses this point directly.
Yes. One of the reasons why I wrote Though the Heavens May Fall, which tells the story of how James Somerset and his lawyers used the judicial system to move him from being a thing to a person, really to take him out of slavery and in the same way take thousands of other slaves out of slavery as well in England, is that they went in front of the judge and every argument that you can imagine was made both pro and con about slaves. And that's why I wrote the book, because they come page after page after page. You can see all kinds of arguments that slavery is good as a matter of public policy. Slavery is bad as a matter of public policy. Slavery is good as a matter of history. Slavery is bad as a matter of history. Slavery is right as a matter of precedent. No, there aren't precedents. The reason I wrote the book is because that was so thoroughly argued and litigated that they made every possible argument that you can think of. And I wanted to show how Lord Mansfield was able to like wade his way through that legal mess and do the right thing. And it was in a series of hearings that ended on June 22nd, 1772. First, he came to the next last hearing that was in May of 1772. And at that point, Lord Mansfield did not want to have to decide the case. And what he did was try to get the parties to settle. But at that time, by that time, both sides were deeply entrenched. James Somerset's master was not really in charge of the case. It was now the West Indian slave interests, the sugar interests, who were coming in and representing the master, because they did not want any thought of slavery ending even in England. And so, meanwhile, on the other side were the best civil rights lawyers of the day, representing James Somerset. And so both sides were engaged in what we understand to be a test case. I'm not so sure that they thought about it in those terms in 1772 London. And so they refused to settle the case. And Lord Mansfield then kind of threw his hands up and said in Latin, well, then let justice be done, though the heavens may fall. And then a month later, he then announced that slavery was so odious, and he used the word odious, slavery was so odious that the common law would not support it, and that he freed James Somerset through a writ of habeas corpus. And that is what we are trying to make judges face and encourage them to take similar sorts of actions with respect to our non-human animal plaintiffs.
And like 2 minutes left, Well, I was going to ask, what are the implications of your work? But I think instead what I'd like to ask, you can answer that if you want, but we only got 2 minutes. How can people help? What do you want them to do?
Well, we are, up until now, whenever anyone has asked that, we have said, well, you can send the Non-Human Rights Project money and help fund lawyers. I mean, people can always do that. But we've also decided over the last eight months that we are going to expand the scope of the work that we are doing so that people can do work for us. And an important part of that has been that I began a series of meetings with a man named Evan Wolfson, who in 1983 as a Harvard Law student wrote the first law review article arguing that gays should have the right to marry under the 14th Amendment. He then went on to work in Lambda Legal and then formed an organization called Freedom to Marry, and was really the center of the burgeoning gay marriage movement, you know, for two decades. And then he finally won. He won in June of 2015. And Evan has been gracious enough to sit down with us and repeatedly and talk to us about how he and all of those around him were able to win. And so we go to him, we take notes, we ask him how he did this, how he did that. He's given us many things he wrote, not only as after he won, but, you know, 10 or 15 years ago in the darkest days of 2004 when it looked just awful, that it could never happen. And so we are, and he has something that he calls a ladder of clarity that we have studied and we think is a really good idea. And the ladder of clarity that we're beginning to work on will bring us past litigating alone, but will involve doing many, many other things that we hope will be synergistic with our litigation. So while we're not yet ready right now for other people to step in and do some kind of work, a year from today, we will be ready to have anyone come in and help us.
Well, thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Stephen M. Wise. This is Derek Jensen from Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.